Welcome to Functional Medicine Bite-Sized, the podcast where Pete chats to experts in the field of functional medicine and health, giving you, the listener, pearls of wisdom to apply on a daily basis.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome to our new Functional Medicine Bite-Sized podcast. And really, today is just starting the introduction, which is going to be a pretty deep dive, not just today, but in later episodes, really around HRT, really around women of that age, and really getting a deeper understanding of this whole subject, which is pretty huge, to say the least. So I'm going to introduce one of the clinicians that we work with on this side. This is Dr. Ghazala Azizi Scott, and I'm going to give her a brief introduction before we let her give you an understanding of where she's come from and how she has ended up being the clinical lead, clinical director for the real sort of world-famous Marion Gluck Clinic. And this is, as I say, is a clinic that provides integrative women's health. And again, there's a big change from 10 or 15 years ago, but they're using a fully integrated functional medicine systems biology approach with an expertise really in sort of balancing hormones, but using sort of bioidentical hormones to do that. Ghazala, morning. How are we doing?
Good morning. Lovely to be with you, Pete.
Yeah, it's we chat quite a bit, don't we? Because obviously we're working in some way, shape or form together.
Yeah.
And I would say that you and your clinic, which you've got quite a few clinicians on board now. And obviously a lot of people in certainly in the functional medicine space know about bioidentical hormones. They know about the Marion Gluck Clinic. Why don't you just, I think, maybe start off to give our listeners your story, because it's a pretty big one. You've done some amazing things over the time, but sort of amalgamate that into where you're spending most of your time now.
Sure, sure. So my medical education started at Cambridge, where I did neuroscience, medical ethics and law. So I've always been sort of interested in the bigger picture. I'm very interested in science and research. And then I did clinical medicine at Oxford. I trained as a GP, and I was a GP partner in Ealing, West London for 23 years. So I've got a huge amount of sort of conventional medical experience. But I was always interested in the mind-body connection. And, you know, my consultations in general practice always overran massively because I was always interested in the patient's narrative. Then in 2019, I thought, well, I need to do something different. I need to explore what other things I can do. So I joined, I decided to train with the Marion Gluck Training Academy, and I was completely intrigued by bioidentical hormones. I see a lot of women patients, you know, throughout the years. I've seen women, you know, in my 23-year history as a general practitioner, I saw women through the whole life cycle. And, you know, now they were all middle-aged and menopausal like myself. So I was thinking, oh, you know, there's going to be some golden nuggets here that I could take back to my general practice. But I was actually totally amazed by this world of bioidentical hormones. We had a very inspiring teacher who was also a GP, and she said that the world of bioidentical hormones and what she'd been able to do for her patients was one of the most rewarding parts of her career. So after that 2-day training, you know, I think I was very enthusiastic. I was always in the front row of the lecture theatre. And so they said, oh, you seem to be really interested in this. Would you like to come and meet our CEO and see whether you can come and do some work with us? So I then met up with the CEO, decided to start working at the Marion Gluck Clinic one day a week. And that's where my interest in bioidentical hormones started. At the same time that year, I went to Seattle to do the introductory course in functional medicine. And that was another aha moment, because I just, you know, a few months before, being on this GP update course where we had every single speciality known to man. And the end point for each of those specialities as to what treatment can we give people, you know, when we don't know what else to do, there were all these powerful, you know, immune drugs and TNF blockers and stuff like that. So it was like, well, why aren't we looking at what the root cause is? So I was already beginning to think inflammation. Then I went to you know, the introductory course in Seattle, and I was really blown away by that whole approach. And suddenly I felt, well, I've come home. I've actually found a system of practicing medicine that actually resonates with how I've tried to practice for the last 20 or 30 years. So I then, you know, we then had lockdown. So I live streamed all of the advanced practice modules over that period of time, got, you know, trained up in functional medicine. And then I realized that there's such a synergy between bioidentical hormones and the communication node of the functional medicine model, and how important it was, you know, to have personalization of hormone treatments and to use hormone balancing in so many different female health conditions. So at the Marion Gluck Clinic, you know, it used to be very much perimenopause and menopause, but now we are using that functional medicine approach to integrate across lots of different women's health problems. So that's where it all began. And then, you know, what I realized as well is that, you know, in our functional medicine training, we're given a lot of scientific knowledge in the advanced practice module, but we don't know how then to access further bioidentical hormone training and how to actually put that in practice in the UK. So I then did a guest lecture for the IFM advanced practice module to help delegates understand how they can get further training in bioidentical hormones and how we can then you know, access them in the UK. So what I'm really pleased to say is that in our Marion Gluck Training Academy 2-day course, which I now run at the Royal Society of Medicine twice a year, we now have perinatal psychiatrists coming who are really interested in the role of hormones in mood disorders. You know, it's not just about drugging people up with SSRIs. And we're having a lot of people from the functional medicine space who are also now learning how to use those bioidentical hormones, because it is a real field in itself. And I think you have to get quite a bit of experience in how to use them. You know, you can have the practical, theoretical knowledge, but the actual practice of it does take you know, there's an art to it. So it takes some expertise. So then I trained in functional medicine. I worked for a leading functional medicine clinic for about 6 months, took a sabbatical from the NHS. And then I thought, right, I've got to throw myself into this wholeheartedly. So then I became the clinical leader of the Marion Gluck Clinic and brought functional medicine to the Marion Gluck Clinic. And I think it sort of all came at an opportune time, because when Marion Gluck first started bioidentical hormones, she was a pioneer in her field and no one else was doing it. You know, we were still using synthetic hormones in the mainstream. But really, in the last few years, mainstream medicine also recognizes that bioidentical hormones are the gold standard. So now in the mainstream, you can get regulated bioidentical hormones. And a lot of the regulated menopause clinics, or a lot of private menopause clinics, have mushroomed now. So there's a lot of people who are doing regulated bioidentical hormones. But really, we have such a unique approach because we are doing personalized bioidentical hormones, and we are integrating that into understanding how does the body then process those hormones. So we're looking at how estrogen is metabolized and cleared. We're looking at gut health, and all of these things are so important, because you can't just view your hormones as one aspect of your health. You've got to view your hormones as a function of your entire health. So that's where, you know, I think really this has got to be the gold standard. You know, and I've worked in the conventional space for decades. So I've done, you know, worked with women in the NHS, and now I'm doing the Marion Gluck sort of personalized work. And I really do think that, you know, we need to be collaborating. I think being in two camps is not healthy. Mm-hmm. I think we have you know, the conventional space have so much to learn from how we do things. And unfortunately, you know, that time lag between scientific evidence and research and actually putting it into practice is about 17 years. Throw in economics and the failing health system and, you know, the fact that there aren't the resources, you know, we've got this real mismatch between where the patient's falling in the middle, you know, because the patient has their needs right this moment in time. And, you know, I really feel that, you know, we really need to be doing our best to get the best outcomes for our patients.
And isn't this the thing? I mean, this is how we met, wasn't it? Because, you know, I've been in practice 25 years with our group, and, you know, we approached many endocrinologists. So as I look at what we do, it's a question of we're pretty good at understanding. I like to say it, you're almost like the conductor of the orchestra. So you've got a really good idea of how everything needs to meet and fit together so that you play really nice music. But that doesn't mean to say that in every stage of that, there is going to be a component where you need someone else who has a specialization in a certain specialist area to allow you to play the music. And I can remember, as I said, when we went out for dinner, we had that conversation, is that, you know, the reason why I hadn't come for years to come and see your group again is because we'd just been let down. No, I mean, let down is the wrong word, but we'd gone to send some of our patients to endocrinologists who were very traditional, conventional endocrinologists, doing the right job, but completely missing the bigger picture. And so we ended up in a situation where quite a few of our patients just really didn't get good results because the clinicians weren't thinking about the bigger picture. And I think that's so refreshing about how quick, certainly, the endocrine space has moved from a point of view of, we can't just keep on tweaking your end-stage estrogen or progesterone without thinking about the bigger picture, because we'll just go pillar to post every 3 months. And that's been the great thing about I'm not going to say the industry, but where endocrinology has gone, particularly with women's HRT. And that, as I say, it just makes us feel very comfortable about, if we send a patient over to you, you guys know what you guys have got to do, and then we can bash it straight back. So that's what, again, I think what has been really great for us, because that's changed massively. So I think we've sort of opened up on that. Can we just sort of start with some fundamental basics? Because I said, sure, to you, most of the people who are going to listen to this will be female of an age. And, you know, as I said to you, my 51-year-old wife is currently just started underneath your on your care, because she's perimenopausal now. And so it's she's not going to listen to me, not that I know it. And again, passing it on that side would be great. But What are the sort of just things, the sort of basics about what is happening to a woman as they go through perimenopause and into menopause? And can we talk about where just the basics with regards to risks are? And then if we can we go to the rewards of HRT, and then we can move on to how a conventional approach maybe doesn't match what a bioidentical systems biology approach would work?
Sure. So the average age of menopause in the UK is 51. So menopause is defined as a cessation of periods for 12 months. So it's a technical diagnosis, really, because we don't just fall off a cliff at the age of 51 and our periods just stop. So now we have much more recognition of this phase before menopause, which is the perimenopausal period. Now, the perimenopausal period can go on for a decade. And really, I think women's hormone patterns start changing when they're in their early 40s. And the perimenopausal phase is where the cycles are changing. And specifically the luteal phase. The luteal phase is the second half of the cycle. So from ovulation to when the period starts. During that phase, we should have a really good level of progesterone production. And progesterone is our natural calming hormone. So when you've got a good, healthy menstrual cycle with good levels of progesterone, progesterone is soothing and calming, and in general, people have, you know, a good experience of their menstrual cycle. When you've got perimenopause and you are starting to have anovulatory cycles, so you're not ovulating every month, or the amount of progesterone you're producing goes down, that's when you start getting symptoms of the perimenopause. So the classic symptoms of the perimenopause are symptoms of progesterone deficiency, which are anxiety. You know, women are saying, oh, you know, I feel really anxious when I'm driving on the motorway because I feel I'm going to crash. You know, kind of more anxiety, overthinking about things, feeling that they're not coping as well, and insomnia. So, you know, people find that their sleep pattern is really, really disrupted. They also can sometimes get physical symptoms of anxiety. So you get a lot of women who are suddenly start palpitating, think they've got some chest pain, they end up in A&E, and actually they're perimenopausal and it's a progesterone deficiency. And the number of women I saw when I was in general practice who had a full cardiology workup when they were perimenopausal. So I think this is the thing to look out for. Now, a lot of women, when they're going through that perimenopausal phase, they're actually pretty stressed out. You know, they've got jobs, yeah. they've got teenagers, they've got, yeah. you know, long-term relationships. So sometimes it can be quite difficult to tweak out what is causing my symptoms. Is it the perimenopause or is it my life in general? And actually there's this big overlap. And we know that when you are more stressed, and so this is where, you know, the beauty of the functional medicine system, where we're looking at people's cortisol patterns, we're looking at how stressed yeah. people are. Mm-hmm. When people are in high stress, their experience of the perimenopause is much worse because progesterone is really impacted by cortisol. So when our stress hormones are high, cortisol can also compete with progesterone receptors. So you might produce a level of progesterone in your second half of your cycle, but the cortisol is taking over. The cortisol is becoming dominant. So you feel very stressed and you've got less progesterone on board. So this is where the symptoms can become much worse. Also, you know, I think it's really important to think about, you know, people's previous history. So when we do a very comprehensive history, people who've had a lot of trauma, childhood stress, they also experience the perimenopause in a more heightened manner because they have adrenal dysregulation. So their adrenal glands are not functioning in an optimum way. So this is another thing that we layer into mm-hmm. when we're assessing people. So that those are the symptoms of the perimenopause. Now, in that phase, estrogen levels can be very fluctuant. So in conventional medicine, when someone presents with any kind of perimenopausal middle age symptoms, people are immediately put on estrogen and progesterone as HRT, because in the conventional model, the NICE guidelines state that if a woman is over 45, do not do any blood tests, do not do any testing, just put them straight onto HRT. Now, the progesterone bit of it is okay, but the problem is with the estrogen. So we also know now that in the perimenopause, women have different patterns of estrogen production. So we know that in that perimenopausal period, a lot of women can become very estrogen dominant. Sure. So they have levels of estrogen that are higher than when they were having normal menstrual cycles. Now, that higher estrogen coupled with lower progesterone is what produces the imbalance, the hormonal imbalance of a lot of perimenopausal women. So the estrogen dominance will present with breast tenderness, more PMS type symptoms, bloating, fluid retention, migraines. So if you then give those women estrogen as well as progesterone in the conventional system, because we're not doing any testing, they're going to feel dreadful. And they're going to think, well, I don't actually tolerate HRT. So I'm going to give up on this. And it's very easy to kind of get people off piste. You know, if they've had a bad experience, to get them back on the road can be quite difficult. So I think it's so important to be able to distinguish between the hormonal patterns someone's experiencing, until the time at which they reach the menopause. So that's a technical definition, but we can have all sorts of patterns of hormonal imbalance leading up to that period of time. And I think stress plays a major factor. And that's where I think, you know, people say, oh, well, our ancestors went through the menopause and the perimenopause and they didn't have any problems. Well, your average 50-year-old 100 years ago would, you know, may have died in childbirth, would definitely be a grandmother, would definitely be retired, would definitely be doing their knitting by the fire. So they didn't have, the same experience of what they were expected to do at the age of 45 or 50 compared to 100 years ago. So I think it's also, you know, we need to think about what are we expecting of the average woman these days, and from an evolutionary point of view, we haven't evolved. I mean, you know, ideally, you know, menopause needs to go in proportion to the retirement age, really, doesn't it? You know, it would be ideal if we could go into menopause when we retire, but you know, that's not happening.
I think there's a lot to unpack on there. I'm going to say one thing in a minute. I'm pretty sure your mic's still a bit too high, so can we whack it down to a little bit less on your mic?
Yeah, right.
But let's go back and I'm going to unpack quite a few things there. It makes me chuckle that you get a lot of people saying, well, Paleolithic man or woman didn't do that and they were fine. And it's like, well, yeah, but Paleolithic man or woman basically died before they were 40 anyway. So again, I suppose what we're trying to say is that, you know, this is a different world. We're living much longer. We're living much longer than we did from our ancestors, and therefore we need a different approach. And I still find it, so maybe you can answer this for me. I know we have nice guidelines with regards to testing. Do you think that is still validated in the science, or do you think that is partly because, and look, don't get me wrong, there's a money-saving aspect to this because, you know, you can't be testing everyone all the time. So do you think it's a combination of both? Because obviously the reality is we're trying to do population-based medicine, which may be completely inappropriate for the patient, which is, of course, why they have not a great experience. So what would you say on that?
I mean, I think testing is vital. I really do, because it, you know, yes, hormones are fluctuant, but you get so much information from doing a hormone profile. You know what is the FSH and LH? Yes, it may fluctuate, but you get a pretty good idea from looking at everything in the hormonal picture, which is the hormones that come from the brain that go up when our ovarian hormones are fluctuating. We know we can get a luteal phase progesterone, so we know how much progesterone are you producing. We can get a ratio between the estrogen and progesterone production in the luteal phase, so we can say, is this patient estrogen dominant or not? Because we want a ratio of 10 to 1 in terms of estrogen and progesterone. So, you know, if we get an estrogen of 1,000 and a progesterone of 0.5, we know that they're way out of whack. So again, it gives us information. Also, we don't just look at estrogen and progesterone in the functional sort of functional endocrinology space. We also look at testosterone, we look at DHEA, we look at cortisol patterns. The other thing is that there are a lot of coexisting things that can happen in middle age. So we know that people can become more insulin resistant. Sure. We know that people can become hypothyroid. And all of those things are linked with the hormonal changes we're going through. You know, so with the perimenopause and menopause, we do become more insulin resistant. With the estrogen dominance of perimenopause, we can become hypothyroid. So to be able to look at someone's baseline health, so our initial profile is looking at metabolic health, general health, it's looking at liver function. You know, you might give someone some hormones, but you want to make sure that they are going to be able to detoxify those hormones. Yeah. And then we're looking at their hormonal patterns. So, I think the sort of guess don't test, I would say no, test don't guess. It's really, really important. The other thing is, I think, you know, we have the privilege of our amazing functional testing, and I absolutely love the Dutch test. So I think the Dutch test gives us so much information. So, you know, for our listeners, the Dutch test stands for dry urine total comprehensive hormone analysis. And all of these hormones in our body produce, as they're processed in the body, they produce metabolites, which are then excreted in the urine. So by looking at these urinary metabolites and also salivary metabolites, we can get a really good idea of what is the pattern of hormones in your system. How are you metabolizing those hormones in your liver? How are you clearing them? We get a lot of clues to what's happening with a person's body, and also the adrenal profile. I mean, I think looking at someone's adrenal health is so important when you are looking at someone's overall hormonal health. The other thing that is amazing about functional endocrinology is we actually recognize the interactions between all of the hormone systems. So even a conventional endocrinologist, they see each endocrine system as sort of functioning in isolation. Yeah, and totally. I find it so hard to believe, you know, that they can't, that there's not this sort of understanding of those interactions. You know, we know that when cortisol is dysregulated, we know that it has an impact on thyroid stimulating hormone. We know that it has an impact on prolactin. We know that there are all of these hormonal interactions, and yet there's still that penny missing when it comes to conventional endocrinology, where they're looking at pathology. So they're looking at, okay, what happens when your adrenal glands are not producing any cortisol? So you've got Addison's disease. Or what happens when your adrenal glands producing too much cortisol and you're Cushingoid? No one looks at the imbalances and the nuances in the same way that we do in the functional medicine space. And I think that is so important. So we have got the hang of it in some things. So when you're looking at diabetes, for instance, there's real recognition in the conventional medicine space that diabetes as an endocrine condition is reversible. In terms of being hypothyroid, it was really interesting. A lot of the people who come on the functional medicine training are people who have reversed their own Hashimoto's. Sure. And when I was a conventional doctor, I would never have even known that you could actually, reverse autoimmunity, or not so much reverse it, but you could actually hold it in its tracks a lot more. And there was so much you could do to support a patient. So I think that, the way we're taught conventional medicine is very, very black and white. And we're not taught about the nuances that I think are so important. And we know that if we can help patients with their imbalances, then we can prevent disease. So what I really love about functional medicine, and indeed doing bioidentical hormones, is that there's a lot of prevention. And it's much harder to get people well when they've got a disease compared to when they've got an imbalance. It's much easier to get people into a better space.
I think that the difficulty is with all of that is that we have been in a paradigm. We live in a paradigm where if there's something wrong with us, we go to the doctors, and that's how we've been brought up. And so we don't really know anything different, and we don't tend to do anything until pathology and disease turns up. I think there's a massive change on that. The problem is I sometimes look at. And look, we've got, everyone moving into this space is becoming more and more successful because people are recognizing I need to do something now to save me later on. And we can have a chat up certainly about brain health and perimenopause on that side, because we're doing quite a bit of work on that side. But I think it's because you've lived in that paradigm of just going to the doctors when there's not some when you're ill, it's very difficult to recognize that on a daily basis you need to be doing preventative. So mm-hmm. that you get into your 60s, 70s and 80s and you live a pretty good as minimal intervention from medicine as possible. And that's a hard buy-in. But more and more I look at this and I see that people are buying in. Because I think more, look, I don't think we're ever on here to dismiss conventional medicine because it absolutely has its role with regards to pathology and disease and, an emergency medicine. I mean, there's no doubt on that. But it's not the approach where I think the general public is generally needing with regards to, there are certain things that you have to do on a daily basis to try and keep yourself in shape. Can we go on to now? Obviously, there's two approaches, isn't it? And again, I think we've got to be careful on this. I mean, the great thing about you and your history is you've had 25 years in the NHS.
Mm-hmm. So 30 years.
Well, there you go. So so it's not as if you haven't spent the time in the trenches and understand people who may be listening to this can't afford to go to somewhere like the Marion Gluck Clinic. And I think it would be great if we can get some tips of the trade on that one. But I think you've done a really nice introduction, but when we're talking about the medications that we would be given for HRT, what is the difference between just sort of the conventional medicines that would be given and the bioidentical hormones on that? And can we get into a little bit about and compounding pharmacies, because I know what a compounding pharmacy is, but probably most people don't. So if we could get into that, that'd be awesome.
Sure. So, I mean, I completely agree. I think we're very privileged to have a public health system in the UK. As I just said to you earlier, Pete, I was just in the States doing some training. And actually, although they have very advanced scientific research, because they don't have a public medical system, menopause falls through the net because you can't claim it on insurance.
Yep.
So actually, menopause care in the USA is really, really expensive. Now, thank goodness, the NICE guidelines from 2019 onwards have recognized that bioidentical hormone treatments are the way forward for women in the perimenopause and the menopause.
Can you just explain to everyone what the NICE guidelines are? Because again, sure. I think this is a really important point.
Sure. So the NICE guidelines stand for the National Institute for Clinical Excellence. So the NHS work with NICE to produce protocols and guidelines that general practitioners can use to provide evidence-based healthcare to their patients. So, you know, as a general practitioner, you see millions and millions of different things. So having these nice guidelines can be incredibly helpful to help you manage your patients. So essentially, the NICE guidelines advocate bioidentical hormones. Now, I'll explain to you what is a bioidentical hormone. So a bioidentical hormone is a hormone that has the same chemical structure as our own natural hormones. They come from plant sterols. So they come from Mexican yams and sweet potatoes. And it's really fascinating to think that, you know, humans and plants evolved together because these products, you know, these compounds are in the animal kingdom, in the plant kingdom. And basically these hormones are then extracted into powders and then made into formulations. So the NICE guidelines recognizes that this is the best way. If you think if a bioidentical hormone has the same structure, it's going to fit into a receptor site in your body in the same way as your own natural hormone. And that means that you're going to have a much better physiological response. Now, conventionally, before sort of in the last decade, what was happening is that we were using synthetic hormones for HRT. So there was this massive study in 2002. It was called the Women's Health Initiative. Mm-hmm. And they used synthetic hormones for HRT. And obviously there were some very negative side effects from that. And that gave HRT a really bad name. And lots of women came off their HRT. And so we had a period of time for about a decade where people weren't being prescribed their HRT. But actually now, NICE recognizes that we need to give people bioidentical hormones. So the ones that we get in the NHS are what we call regulated bioidentical hormones. So they are made by pharmaceutical companies in standardized doses and formulations that have had controlled clinical trials done on them. So that means that, the pharmaceutical companies or educational bodies have taken a cohort of women, put them on this treatment, and then they've looked at the outcome measures. So they've looked at how many of these women had adverse outcomes, how many women had beneficial outcomes. They can look at what this regulated HRT did in these women. So the outcomes are really, really good. They're very, very positive for using regulated body identical or bioidentical hormones. They're very good outcomes. And for most women, the benefits to the health in the long run in terms of their brain health, their heart health, their bone health, and there's a very minimum risk of breast cancer with five to 10 years use of bioidentical hormone treatment. So the regulated treatments are really, really good. And for the majority of women, they will work well. Now, so there are
a lot. Can I just break that down? Because again, it comes down to these studies have been done with a group of individuals. They do a population based, and then we do the classic sort of Gaussian curve, don't we? We look at where the mean is, and the dosages are generally made up from a point of view of where the majority of the population that have been tested sit. But within that, you have people who don't sort of are on the outside of the curves where that dosage may be completely inappropriate for them. So it's definitely a step forward, isn't it? It's definitely a step forward, moving
it's a step
things
forward. And at least, you know, most women have access to these. You've got to hope that your GP is trained up in understanding this. You know, there's a lot more education. They want to bring a lot more menopause education into the curriculum because there was a big hole there. Mm-hmm. And even within, you know, even within sort of specialities, you know, gynecologists and obstetricians are more interested in, you know, operations and delivering babies. Endocrinologists, as we've discussed, are more interested in pathology. So actually, menopause care does fall into the lap of the GP, but then most GPs don't absolutely have, you know, the specialist knowledge. So there's a lot more education going on. There's a lot more awareness. You know, everyone, most women who are GPs know that they absolutely need to know about the menopause and what the NICE guidelines are because the demand is there. So there's a lot of education going along, which is great. And as I said, for the majority of people, this is fantastic because, you know, these regulated body identical, bioidentical hormones work quite well. But you only get estrogen and progesterone. Testosterone is still a bit of a gray area in conventional medicine, and there is only one compounded preparation available for women. So testosterone preparations for women have to be in a lower dose compared to men. So there isn't much availability of this in the NHS. So if they think a woman needs testosterone, they're giving her smaller amounts of a male preparation, which is not very scientific. So the other thing is the only real form of natural progesterone or bioidentical progesterone in the conventional space is oral utrogestan. So it's an oral micronized progesterone capsule, which for the majority of women works really well. But a lot of women do not tolerate oral progesterone, or they need a much lighter dose. You know, 100 milligrams is too much for them and they get side effects. So we don't have the flexibility to adjust doses according to the woman. And different people also metabolize hormones in different ways. Yeah. So what, you know, what one person may do very well on, another person may not, or another person may get side effects at, you know, a similar dose. So individualization is definitely very important.
Isn't this the crazy thing about this? Because, you know, as I said to you, we're very experienced people in this, and you recognize that even with the best job that I may do at the beginning and the best job that you may do, it's the first fit of the wedding dress, isn't it? You know, we think we've done our due diligence with you, we've done the testing, and here's the first fit of the dress, but it might not be the perfect fit, and we might need to just adjust all the time.
Yeah.
And so that recognition of, you know, to do this job well, one consultation is never going to solve that issue. I mean, it's crazy when you think about it. I suppose that's more about the way, certainly conventionally, that just the structure of medicine is, isn't it? It's very, very difficult to be able to give an individual, you know, the great results that they may be expecting for so little time. And even just on the, you know, even on the wider aspect of just GPs in general, it's incredible what a GP can do in such little time and get such great results given the time frame. I find it quite incredible.
Absolutely. I mean, you know what, it's really, you know, when I first went into general practice, 30 years ago, you know, we had time for patients. And also because I was in a wonderful family practice, we had continuity of care. I saw my same patients. So I might not be able to give them a 1 hour consultation at the start, but as I saw them repeatedly, I built up a real idea about that patient over a period of time. And also, you know, I knew what their life history was because, you know, I was kind of following them. You know, as I said, you know, I followed women from, you know, when I joined there, I had children, to when we all had children, we went through the trials and tribulations of parenthood. And then, you know, we got to perimenopause and menopause. So, you know, you sort of build up your own, your own life experience, and your patient's, you know, life experience kind of goes in parallel. So you do have a deeper understanding of your patient, you know, when we had that traditional family practice model. Now, unfortunately, you know, general practice has just turned, and, you know, after COVID, you know, there's so much more telephone consultation, the resources are limited, you know, really and truly the whole nature of general practice has changed. We were able to deliver much more personalized care, you know, and we're able to do the kind of the spiritual side of medicine a lot better when we had that continuity of care. You know, and we're constantly seeing articles in the media, aren't we, about the importance of continuity of care, but continuity of care just doesn't happen anymore. And, you know, there's so much, you know, there are issues with resources, you know, it's very difficult to recruit GP partners. You know, the younger generation are wanting to do more sort of portfolio careers. So, you know, they're doing ad hoc sessions here and there. So you don't build up that rapport with the patient over, you know, their lifespan, which is also so important for your own education and what you learn about the human condition, which is also very important as a doctor.
There's no doubt on that. And again, I think on that, knowing the person behind the person behind the person is one of the key skill sets that you're going to get great results with. So can we go back to, again, when we talked about, didn't we? We talked about how a bioidentical, they're regulated, and there's only certain things that you can get, and maybe we might be missing the bigger picture with regards to testosterone, etc. Can you talk about how it works with you guys from a point of view of the bioidenticals, but also from a point of view of how you can manipulate the dose and how you do that.
Sure. So, you know, when we're assessing someone for their hormones, we are also using that sort of functional approach where we look at the production of hormones, we look at the transport, we look at the sensitivity. So we look at, how much your body is going to receive those hormones. So if you have not had if you've been menopausal for a few years or you've had hormonal balances for a number of years, your body has got used to that situation. So what happens to your receptors where the hormones will dock onto and to your cells is that they get downregulated. So if you suddenly start someone on a really high dose of hormones, actually they may not tolerate it very well or they may get side effects. So what we tend to do is we tend to start with low doses. We start low and we go slow, and we monitor a patient in terms of their symptoms, the side effects, what doses we're using. So, you know, we like to use the lowest dose possible to get the best outcome.
Absolutely.
So we're not dosing people up. So it's much more about balancing rather than sort of, you know, over-medicating people with hormones. So what we tend to do, so basically we with compounding, so compounding a dose of hormones means that we can actually decide what dose of hormones to start you on. So for instance, I'll just give you an example. In the conventional space, you might start someone on one pump of estradiol, which is about 0.75 of estrogen. We would start people on maybe 0.25 twice a day. So we'll start them on 0.25, see how they tolerate it, then go up to 0.25 twice a day. So we're able to kind of tailor the doses a lot more to the patient and start people on low doses and then work up. There's a lot. One of the major controversies about compounded medications is the progesterone question. So we do use transdermal progesterone. And at this moment in time, there isn't enough evidence, so that there are not enough trials that have been done to show that transdermal progesterone can adequately protect the lining of the womb. So when we give people estrogen, it makes the lining of the womb get thicker, and progesterone causes the lining of the womb to get thinner. So we don't want the lining of the womb to get too thick. So we know from our clinical practice at the clinic that transdermal progesterone is effective in endometrial protection, because we're looking at each individual person and we do a pelvic ultrasound every year to 18 months to monitor that. Now, in the conventional space, there isn't the resource to do that.
Sure.
So people are put on, so the licensed dose for endometrial protection is 100 milligrams of progesterone orally. So that's what you would be given in the conventional space when you're menopausal. But we will start people on, we can give oral progesterone in that way, and sometimes we mix and match. We might start them on low doses of estrogen, and then we might give them some progesterone as an oral preparation, or we might give them transdermal. The other thing that's really important to know is we can give people their medications as transdermal creams, as sublingual troches. So a lot of people do not absorb very well transdermally. So after a while, they may find that their symptoms are returning and the absorption is not so good. So in the conventional space, you have to go straight to oral medication. Whereas what we can do is we can give people sublingual medication where the hormones go into the circulation under the tongue and then go directly into the bloodstream. We can also give people things like rapid dissolve tablets. We can make vaginal preparations. So it's almost like cookery. We can make formulations according to the individual needs of the patients. And also the quality of the ingredients we're using is very, very high. So we're able to concentrate quite a lot of hormone into a very small volume of quality base cream. And that is also very important, because if you look at Sometimes if someone's using, say, 3 or 4 pumps of a conventional estrogen gel, it's actually quite a large volume and they're having to rub it all over their body. Now, we then have the issues of disrupting the skin surface. We have the issues of whether this can transfer to other members of their family or pets. So, you know, there was an article that said that some women were finding that their dogs were getting nipples because there was transference of that estrogen gel onto their animals. So we also need to think about what is the convenience of this preparation. If you're going to have to slap about 4 pumps of estrogen gel onto your body every day for the next 10 years, it's quite a big undertaking. Whereas if you've got 0.3 mils, which is the size of a pea, in a high quality cream that you need to use in one area of your body, you know, it's kind of like, oh, actually there is quite a difference in convenience and then potential compliance as well. So I think that's the joy of compounding, is that we can actually, you know, work to what each individual might benefit from. So there's an art to it, you know, there's an art to making a, you know, a good dish in the compounding world. But having said that, we do stick to, you know, similar doses and guidelines to what we might use in conventional practice. So, you know, it's not that we diverge away. We're using those guidelines as guidelines, but we're also looking at the individual patient and we're looking at, you know, what's going to suit that patient. Now, for instance, when you take oral progesterone, it goes straight into your stomach and it's digested within 20 minutes. The metabolites you produce through digestion, they are very good to support your brain function. So those metabolites, they're called allopregnanolone. They essentially cross the blood-brain barrier and they have a very soothing, calming effect on the brain. So when you have women who've got very high levels of anxiety and insomnia, very often an oral preparation might work better than a transdermal preparation. With a transdermal preparation, it will go into the fat layer under your skin and then it will be gradually absorbed into the bloodstream. So there's also differences in how the hormone gets delivered to your body. And then there is a difference to how that hormone may be metabolized depending on how it's taken. So we are looking at things in a much more detailed, nuanced way that really does, you know, can be very beneficial for the patient. We then also can make compounded testosterone preparations. So we can also put women on very low doses of testosterone creams that are suitable for women, where they're not going to get any adverse side effects. And we can be very specific about the dose. The other hormone that I absolutely love is DHEA. And that's an adrenal hormone that is a precursor to the sex hormones. So very often, you know, when women are perimenopausal and menopausal, if they've got good reserves of DHEA, they often have a bit of a reservoir to support them in that menopausal period. But if their DHEA levels are low, it's an adrenal hormone, so it can be very impacted by long-term stress. Yeah. Then by supplementing them with a little bit of DHEA, we get a much nicer sort of physiological balance for that patient, rather than just pumping them full of estrogen. You know, and I think that's one of the criticisms I'd have of the conventional space is when it's not working, they don't always have the tools to find out what's wrong. So what then happens, and we've seen this time and time again in the clinic, is that people are given higher and higher and higher doses of estrogen. Yeah. We know that, you know, there's a lot more sort of endometrial stimulation. People are bleeding quite a lot through that, but it's not actually tackling the problem, because what may be the issue is the way that hormone's being delivered, whether there's adequate progesterone opposition to that estrogen, whether testosterone is an issue, whether DHEA might help, whether their adrenals are unsupported. So there's a lot of things that we can look at. To, you know, we can also look at, are they clearing those hormones from their body? Is their gut working properly? So when we're looking at when it's not working, we've got so many more tools at hand to actually quantify what's going on. And I think that is where it's very, very helpful. So at the clinic, we are seeing a lot of women who've been to the conventional space and it hasn't worked out for them. And then we have to unravel what's gone wrong, what isn't working, and what can we do to make things better.
I think it brings up a few points, doesn't it? You're working with the mnemonic that we get taught, don't we, which is PTSD, production of the hormone. How is it transported? What is the sensitivity of the receptor sites going to be like? And then importantly, how is everything detoxified?
Yeah,
so,
absolutely.
You know, you're dealing with all of those aspects of all hormones, which are dancing together. And it's a question, as I said to you, is this a problem of menopause, or is this solely, you know, you're probably working on estrogen and progesterone, or is menopause, as the way I see it, it's the great web of all of these hormones dancing at the same time, and what is the best way to make them dance based on the way they present going through perimenopause and menopause? I think also what is clear from the way you've discussed today is that the major difference I see on this is that once you take on a patient, they're put into a strategy, aren't they? You give them a strategy, and that strategy also has a time frame to it. You know, from a point of view of, here's our first fit. This is what we think. And again, start low and go slow. I mean, that goes with everything. And then we see symptomatically how you're doing. Knowing quite well there's a time frame that we're going to have to get together again and go, okay, so how well are we doing? What do the numbers look like? And what's the next step? And so I think what you do in that is that you put people in a consistent strategy. They know they are, and they know that there'll be a time frame where they've got to come back and go, okay, so how well are we doing? Which I think is the major, major difference for me. I mean, that's what we see when we see all of our patients. It's like, here's what we think is going on. Here's what we think we're going to do. And here's the time frame we're going to do that in. And then we're going to have to check in again and see how well we're doing. I think what also you also discussed was the difference between pure evidence-based medicine and evidence-based practice, which I think, again, is the key thing. It's like, yeah, I know that's what the EBM is telling me, but the evidence-based practice suggests that this patient definitely needs a bit more. And I think that's the major difference as I look at it. I cannot believe we're nearly an hour in on this. So what I'm going to do is I just want to just finish off, because, again, we'll have to have you on again. There is so much. I mean, my notes here were, you know, what are the rewards of HRT? We haven't even gone there yet. You know, what are the risk factors? We haven't even gone there yet. And I think we'll have to do that at a different time, because it really needs more. It needs more nuance, more detail, so that people can go away and just sort of listen to the podcast. That, you know, and I really appreciate that you'll come on again and deliver this for us. But I wanted to just sort of summarize again one of the things that you were talking about, because what you talked about several things where maybe things might not go wrong, but what are the risks of HRT with women in certain groups? I know there's a few risks, and also I think, you know, maybe we sort of brief at this now. What are the risks? And I know it's an individually based approach, but what is the risk with different delivery systems of the medication? I mean, and I'm thinking predominantly oral against transdermal or sublingual.
Sure. So in terms, we know that oral estrogen has got a 2 to 3-fold increased risk of thromboembolism. Right. So we know that you've got an increased risk of heart attack, strokes, clots, if you're using oral estrogen. With transdermal, there is no increased risk of clotting. So you can use transdermal estrogens quite safely. So that's a major difference. So, I mean, we always use transdermal estrogen. We don't use oral, but certainly in conventional practice, if the transdermals aren't working, they will use oral. Again, they're weighing up. This lady needs HRT. Transdermals aren't working, so we've got to give her oral. Yes, we've got to balance up the risk, you know, that there is an increased risk of venous thromboembolism, but she needs the HRT. What we can do is if someone's not absorbing very well transdermally, is we can go sublingually. So we're not going down the oral route totally. With absorption under your tongue, you may get a little bit of oral absorption, but the majority of it is going straight into the bloodstream. So you're bypassing, the digestive system, where you can then, you know, produce metabolites that can increase your risk of getting a clot. or a stroke.
And I'm assuming that obviously what you'd be doing now with your due diligence is that, you know, if it's a strong family history of strokes, you would obviously be looking at that from a point of view.
Yeah, or risk factors. If you've got risk factors, like if you're, you know, overweight, you've got diabetes, yeah, you've got high cholesterol, you've got high blood pressure, you'd be looking at the other risk factors to, you know, whether you can. But you see, that's where in the conventional system, you've got a woman who has risk factors for strokes, and she can't tolerate orally, she can't tolerate transdermal, it's not working. What do you do? Because that patient's still got menopausal symptoms, yeah, you know.
So this is the classic risk reward picture, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, I suppose with any medication is that, you know, you're always wanting to have more reward than risk, but the reward is never without some degree of risk. And it's a question of, you know, the clinician balancing that risk out and having that conversation with the patient. Is there any, I mean, so where are we with the risk with regards to breast cancer?
So we know that the risk of breast cancer is 1 in 6 for a woman in the postmenopausal period. So it's quite a high risk anyway. Yeah. Yeah. So we know that for someone who, you know, hasn't got, like, you know, a breast cancer gene, the risk of using bioidentical hormone replacement, and there are plenty of controlled clinical trials that have been done to this, with when you're using transdermal estrogen with oral micronized progesterone, there is no increased risk of breast cancer after 5 years or even 10 years. Now, you've got to remember that the baseline risk is 1 in 6.
Yeah.
But what we also say is that if you are, you know, if you've got symptoms of the menopause, you're not functioning, when you take HRT, your energy levels increase, you're more able to exercise. So all the other risk factors for cancer go down. Yeah. So the risk factor for breast cancer, if you've got obesity, is far higher than if you're taking HRT.
Yeah.
If you're drinking, far higher.
Yeah.
Exercise is protective. So, you know, if you're taking HRT and you're doing a bit more exercise, overall, you might be protecting yourself more. So it's very important to look at the overall risk as well and the quality of life. So that's where we need to balance that up. Now, obviously, if someone's got a family history of breast cancer, or they've got a gene for breast cancer, then, you know, we need to look at those situations individually. So if someone's got a family history, it doesn't mean they can't take HRT. But what we can do is we can really look at the safety of that HRT with a functional approach in a much, you know, in a much more detailed way. So very often, if someone's got a family history of breast cancer or endometrial cancer, I'll make sure that I do their estrogen metabolites. So we know that some estrogen metabolites are more toxic. It's called the 4-hydroxyestrogen metabolite. That's more toxic, and women who've got breast cancer are more likely to produce the more toxic metabolite. So we can look at those risks in a more nuanced way, and we can look at, you know, what we can do to support that woman with that particular situation. So I think that can be quite reassuring. People say, well, look, you're actually metabolizing your estrogen really well.
Yeah.
You know, and we can do genomics and look at how people are clearing their estrogen.
Yeah.
And that can be really reassuring for that person. You can say, look, you've got good detox pathways. You know, you're probably, you know, we can probably put you on HRT quite safely. But if we've got someone who's got really bad detox pathways, we then know we need to support those detox pathways to make the HRT safer for our patient. So I think there are so many nuances, and a lot of it is, there is an element of intuition. There's an element of art to this as well, because there aren't controlled clinical trials about every single situation that we're presented with. So we have to go back to basics. We have to be scientifically informed. This is where, you know, having a good understanding of the science behind hormones is really, really important. And we have to obviously follow guidelines, but, you know, we need to look at each individual patient as well. I mean, there's a very good book called Estrogen Matters by Dr. Avram Blooming, and he's an oncologist based in the USA, and he gives the evidence for and against the use of HRT. Does it increase your risk of breast cancer? And so that's a really interesting book for people to read if they're interested to find out. And with anything in medicine, there are always going to be studies that support, and there are studies that are going to dispute things, because again, the human body is not a machine. And so it's gonna, there's gonna be so much individual variation. And to actually make a study that's totally gonna cover every single aspect of our body is difficult. Yeah. And when you look at the biases that occur when people are doing these studies, you know, also it's quite hard to know what's the truth and what's not the truth.
Absolutely.
You know?
Unless,
Avram Blooming has a statistician who also works with him on the book, because he, as an oncologist, can't understand the detailed statistics behind the data that's producing these trials. So you can make anything fit if you want to. So it's about how do we make sure the information we're presented with is unbiased and true?
Well, I think it's also a question of how do we take a full systems approach with regards to HRT? And as I said to you, if there is someone with slightly more risk factors, what are they contributing to increasing those risk factors by the way they're currently living their life? And again, that's where you can say, okay, yeah, we're at slightly more risk here, but you are overweight, your diet's poor, it's lack of fiber, you're not exercising, you're not sleeping, you're drinking a load. If we got rid of all of those or made some changes to them, we're probably really significantly probably reducing your risk.
Exactly.
And that's where the confidence is. But I think the confidence is, it's a little bit like you were saying about looking at the estrogen metabolites. You know, if you have the capacity to test occasionally and have a look at that, you're getting a really good indication about how the estrogens are being metabolized and how toxic are the metabolites. Are some really good or are some not so good? And how do we change that dietary-wise? Is that, you know, we bring in the crucifer range to try and help that, or is there additional supplementation that can help? And that's the beauty, I think, of what certainly you guys are doing with regards to, I suppose we're calling it functional endocrinology these days.
Yeah, absolutely. And also working in a multidisciplinary team. So, you know, I can see a client in my, for functional medicine, I'll do a 75-minute consultation. For BHRT, 45 minutes to an hour. And I can do a lot of analysis, but then very often that patient needs to have their hand held as they are making those changes and being supported through those lifestyle changes. So I work in very, very closely with nutritional therapists as well, because they can then provide that ongoing support for a few months that can make the world of difference to patients. And that's where, working in that multidisciplinary team. I mean, I never knew what a nutritional therapist did until I started doing functional medicine. And I'm quite blown away by, you know, their knowledge and their expertise. Yeah. It's amazing. It's not like, you know, a conventional dietitian. They have they have to train for 3 years, do a degree. Yeah. Their training is amazing, and what they're able to do in terms of supporting a patient's general health and their pathway back to wellness is amazing. So, you know, I do also believe in working in a team, with nutritional therapists, health coaches, and conventional doctors.
Totally.
Because I'm a conventional GP trained, I will see a patient and I'll say, no, but we need to refer you to this specialist because we need to check this out. And I will work with their specialist. And a lot of specialists are now beginning to get more interested in the functional space. You know, there's now professors of neurogastroenterology. So like they're finally beginning to recognize the link between, you know, the nervous system and gut health. I think, you know, we're moving in the right direction for sure. I really, really hope that even in conventional medical training, you know, the systems approach is going to be taught, because, you know, having been in the system for decades, I just think it's a no-brainer. The systems approach is the most akin to the human body.
Sure.
approach that we can get. And you know, actually, you know, when we look at traditional systems of medicine like Ayurveda, TCM, you know, they all looked at the whole body in a, as a form of systems, didn't they, really? Mm-hmm. And those traditional approaches worked for lots of people. And, you know, there was that element of the healing, you know, where when the practitioner is really invested in helping their patient get better, you know, that energy is transmitted into the consultation. And all of those things make a huge difference, you know, because people feel validated and they feel heard, and that automatically makes them feel better.
No doubt they're going to get better results with patients who feel as though they've been heard and are ready to make the steps, but then has some degree of hand holding as you go down the steps. Ghazala, listen, I really, really appreciate, I mean, I think if it's okay with you, we'll arrange for you to come on pretty quickly, again, if you can, if you can find some space, because there was so much that we go into. Again, we talk a little bit about risk rewards, particularly rewards, but then get into stuff like, you know, brain health, and certainly that change, perimenopause, menopause will be brain health. I mean, that's obviously something that we've already worked with on a patient already. And linking with that. But listen, it's just so much gold dust here that I think if we can squeeze as much as possible out of you, that would be awesome. So
no, I'm really happy to share the knowledge. You know, and it's great to be working with you, Pete. You know, because there is such an overlap between these two fields. So you know, I'm really happy to get the knowledge out there, so you know, people can be empowered to try and find the best solution for themselves.
Yeah, and there's definitely a solution for them. That's the thing. It's not like you're going to get left alone. Yeah, you know what? You might have to invest a little bit into it, but it's definitely there.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, Ghazala, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Look forward to having you on very quickly, hopefully, if you can find some time for us.
Definitely. Right. Definitely.